Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the historic ruling by the FCC on protecting the internet from cable and telecom monopolies, as well as taking on efforts by those same monopolies to preemptively restrict the abilities of communities to offer competitive high-speed internet service. Craig Aaron, the president and CEO of Free Press, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, How We Won Net Neutrality, and the battles ahead in the Congress as Republicans try to restore monopoly control, as well as the broader battle for the U.S. to play catch-up to Japan, South Korea, France, and much of the world in providing universal, low-cost, high-speed broadband internet service. Then we'll speak with David Korn, the Washington bureau chief at Mother Jones magazine, whose reporting uncovering exaggerations and fabrications by Fox News' Bill O'Reilly has been met with character assassination, indignant attacks on the messenger without refuting the message, as Rupert Murdoch's minions circle the wagon around their popular talk show host and best-selling author. We will discuss the irony that NBC's Brian Williams has been fired for embellishing his war zone credentials far less than O'Reilly has done on many occasions without being anywhere near a war zone, all the while claiming to be the truth teller in charge of the no-spin zone. Then finally, we'll examine the apparent lapse in screening immigrants from the former Soviet Union who harbor sympathies and have ties to jihadists, as was the case with the Boston bombers and now appears to be the case with the two Uzbeks and the one Azeri charged by the FBI with plotting to kill the president and attempting to join the so-called Islamic State in Syria. Gordon Hahn, a professor at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies in Monterey and the author of Russia's Islamic Threat and a new book, The Caucasus Emirate, Mujahideen, Global Jihadism in Russia's North Caucasus and Beyond, joins us. And joining us now is Craig Aaron, the president and CEO of Free Press and the editor and co-author of Changing Media, Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. Before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizens Congress Watch, and his latest article at the Huffington Post is How We Won Net Neutrality. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Aaron.
Thanks for having me back on.
And we won, right? That's an amazing thing.
We won.
It looked as if it was going to happen, but, you know, not until the fat lady sings can you celebrate, and I take it you're celebrating.
I am celebrating. I popped the champagne. We'll have, in the weeks ahead, we'll have to dig through those footnotes, make sure there's no small surprises hiding in them, but this is unquestionably a victory. It's unquestionably a victory for grassroots activists who made this happen, and really, it's the biggest win for the public at the FCC, I would argue, in its history.
And it has a lot to do with grassroots democracy, doesn't it? I mean, so often on the political left, and I'm with Pacifica, so we're quite familiar with it, people sort of say there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans, etc. But if you don't vote, you end up with the worst possible outcomes. And if you do participate, you can actually stop the juggernaut of corporate America.
Well, I think this is definitely testament to, you know, organized people can still beat organized money. And, you know, the Democrats were not in a good position when this, the most recent wave of this debate started. They were not ready to protect, real net neutrality. And I'm sure we talked about that several times. But because of the public pressure, because of the organizing, because 4 million people contacted the FCC, because people kept showing up to protest outside, kept calling, it got their attention. And frankly, it created the political space where the president could step forward and say, no, I actually want to do something like this, even if it was after losing an election, saying, I want to step in and say, you should do the right thing. It created the political space where Tom Wheeler, chairman of the FCC, a former cable lobbyist, had the room to move and change his mind. And it was a remarkable scene today down at the FCC. I mean, there were literally standing ovations for the majority at the FCC, and they've never seen that. There's never been a standing ovation at an FCC meeting before. I mean, maybe when somebody retired, but not for something they actually did. And that makes a huge difference. I think that's completely changed the way these folks are going to make decisions over there. We're still going to have fights, including some really big ones coming up. But this is definitely a landmark, a watershed moment where, you know, organizing, activism, using the internet to save the internet really made a huge difference.
And the fact that the FCC got so many emails that their system crashed,
that's right,
surely got the attention of the commissioners, even if they were, and I believe they're under relentless pressure from the corporate powers and the monopolies. I mean,
I would say there's almost no more captured agency historically,
right,
because there's this revolving door spinning between the FCC and the industries it's supposed to regulate. You know, generally, you know, the place is swarming with, you know, cable and phone company lobbyists and others trying to influence what they do there. That's the way things have always gotten done at the FCC. What happened today was a huge exception to that, but I think it does show what happens when you can put some sunlight on a place like the FCC that's not used to public pressure. When the employees of a place like that, who assume nobody knows what they do, suddenly start to recognize that people really care, they're passionate about it, they're willing to put themselves on the line. I mean, people occupied the FCC, they camped outside. They showed up again and again. There were dozens of people in the snow having a rally this morning at the FCC. I think that really gets their attention, really begins to change the way they approach their jobs. And it's something we have to build on, because these are the kind of things we want to have happen. And this wasn't just a defensive battle. In the end, it became, you know, an offensive fight where it was actually about making good public policy. And I think that makes it really a tremendous victory.
And again, I'm speaking with Craig Aaron, the president and CEO of Free Press and the editor and co-author of Changing Media Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. Before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizens Congress Watch, and his latest article at the Huffington Post is How We Won Net Neutrality. But this is not just good news in terms of net neutrality being reclassified and high-speed broadband internet now being considered as a utility. There was also, the FCC approved two petitions filed by municipal broadband providers asking the agency to preempt or override provisions of laws in North Carolina and Tennessee that restrict the ability of communities to offer internet services. And as we know, in Chattanooga, Tennessee, you have 1 gigabit as a public utility, and the average internet speed in the United States is a shameful 9 megabits per second. And here's this gigabit per second as a public utility, and of course, we know that the big monopolies have been suing and getting laws passed in state legislatures to prevent utilities from building up their own fiber optic high-speed broadband services. So that's incredibly good news.
It is. It was remarkable. A lot of great groups that have been working on that fight for a long time as well. I think that, you know, the FCC action today, you know, I think there will be lawsuits, as like there's anything at the FCC, and there'll be some challenges to what they're trying to do. But it really shone a spotlight on this, you know, sort of ridiculous situation happening in at least 19 states across the country where, you know, communities that are not served in most cases by the dominant phone and cable companies or served inadequately are being prevented from building their own services just because of the lobbying clout. I mean, it is sort of one of the most glaring examples of crony capitalism. And it was sort of one of the shocking things in listening to the Republicans who did not support that measure today, because somehow in all their complaints about FCC overreach and what have you, they didn't seem too concerned about the fact that AT&T and Comcast or others were waltzing into state legislatures and passing bans that, you know, merely to serve their very, very narrow business interests. And in some cases, in places they're not even working. So I think this was a real big step in the right direction for the FCC to step forward. And the administration, too, has been increasingly outspoken on this issue of muni broadband. It's one of the promising ways that we could actually begin to, you know, break that cable monopoly, that sort of cartel that controls our internet access, is for communities to actually do it themselves. And what we really want are just as many options as possible. For some communities, that's going to be the right option. For some, it's going to be public-private partnerships. Some are going to try to attract Google. Whatever it is, we just need choices, competition, faster speeds, things that will also encourage those big dominant phone and cable companies that most of us are stuck with to actually improve their service and serve their customers, which they have very little incentive to do because most of us have nowhere else to go.
And indeed, as you pointed out, Craig Aaron, that the Republicans are supposedly the champions of free enterprise, but in effect, they are championing monopolies. And much of the criticism now that's coming from Michael Powell, the former FCC chairman, who who basically changed the internet into the kind of situation that it was in, where it wasn't protected, and now it's been changed back to becoming a utility. He and other Republican commissioners have basically been using the same canard, that which is, well, the internet has evolved in the freewheeling, free enterprise environment, and all of a sudden now big government's coming in to screw it up. Well, I mean, it's so disingenuous that what net neutrality does is protect the freewheeling, free enterprise nature of the internet.
That's absolutely right.
They're about to turn around.
So much of the growth that happened on the internet and things that emerged, you know, were due to net neutrality. And even a lot of things that have happened in recent years, you know, it's been sort of in this de facto net neutrality situation. We've been in limbo while the government's been making these decisions, and the companies were reluctant, you know, to step forward with all their plans. But you have to listen to these companies, not when they're in Washington, but when they actually talk to their own investors, when they go to trade shows, when they're under oath in court. That's when they tell you what they really want to do, and they're very clear that their intention is to discriminate. And that's why there were companies, you know, at the FCC today, Etsy, the internet company that supports a lot of small businesses, people making arts and crafts and things, selling them online, was there to endorse the rules because they're a startup. They're a relatively small company, and they know they don't want to be at the mercy of these big internet service providers, you know, forcing them to grant permission to innovate. And there's so much fear, uncertainty, and doubt being spread by these companies, but it just doesn't withstand any scrutiny. I mean, we have filled the FCC docket with comments showing, you know, things as simple as them refusing to use, you know, real numbers that adjust for inflation when they talk about investment, you know, anything a first-year economist would know to look for, but that's the kind of garbage they're putting into the docket, completely misrepresenting when investment happened. There was far more investment happening, you know, back when things were under Title II than came afterwards. Some of that's just historic in nature. It had nothing to do with the regulatory action, but the fact is there's zero evidence that moving to Title II is going to harm investment. And when these companies' CFOs actually have to talk to investors, and when the SEC is watching, they all admit as much. Cablevision said so today. Verizon said it. Charter Communications, Google, Sprint, T-Mobile. They've all admitted when they have to that, you know, they're just trying to get everything they can out of Washington, but this isn't really a threat to them or their investments. But if we lose net neutrality, it's definitely a threat to the ability of people to invest in new companies, new startups, new ways of doing things, and that's who we should really be worried about. There's another Google in a garage somewhere. There's another Facebook being developed in a dorm room somewhere. There's a lot of people who need the internet to communicate their original ideas, to organize, and you lose net neutrality, you could lose all that. Comcast and Verizon, though, they're going to be fine.
Well, you know, I've been worried all along that the simple explanation hasn't been out there, because the word net neutrality is a pretty amorphous term. And for people to understand, and as we've just mentioned, what's being said now in criticizing the decision by Republican commissioners and supporters like Ted Cruz, who says this is Obamacare for the internet, the idea that they're saying, well, it was free and it worked pretty well without government interference, and now the government's interfering, when in fact what was at stake here was that the powerful corporations are about to take it over, monopolize it, and cableize it, and turn it into the same kind of crappy service that you have from cable providers and monopolies that control the pipe into your home.
And then pick and choose the channels for you, because that's their vision for the internet, right? They love that giant menu you have to flip through for channels, most of which they own or control or get a piece of. But the beauty of the internet is I don't have to go through that. I can just go find the content I want. And you and I know that if they were able to get away with it, you know, Pacifica is not going to get a spot on the first tier. That's not going to be allowed. You know, maybe you'll be able to get it if you dig a little bit. Whereas on the free and open internet, if you do an interesting show, if you have provocative guests, if you have something important to say, you actually do have just as much a chance as Rush Limbaugh or Fox News or anybody else to find that audience. And we've seen it happen again and again and again. That's the beauty and the promise of the internet. And at least for today, we've managed to preserve that a little longer, and hopefully forever.
So you mentioned earlier, Craig Aaron, that you're concerned that, you know, even though it's a great victory, that it's not over, and you wanted to go through the paperwork, if it will, to look at the small print. What wrinkles could there possibly be?
you know, in anything, this is an FCC order that's probably going to run to the hundreds of pages. And, you know, the reason we have lawyers here at Free Press is to go over that and make sure there's nothing that could be misconstrued or is problematic or endorses some kind of problematic behavior. And, you know, for example, there's been a lot of fighting within the FCC just in the last week about some language, you know, that we felt was really unnecessary, that would have sort of classified services in an interesting and frankly confusing way. It was sort of left over from the earlier FCC approaches around Section 706 and what's called a hybrid approach. That ended up actually coming out of this order, which I think is a very good victory, thanks to Commissioner Clyburn and others who are pushing on that. So there's things like that that you need to watch out for. There's some emerging issues that I'm not sure how the agency is going to deal with, things related to interconnection, you know, where the big pipes meet each other, say Netflix connects to Comcast and things like that, and issues like zero rating, where cell phone companies want to exempt certain services from their data caps, you know, based on who cut a deal with them. So there's going to be things to look at. But the bottom line for people, you know, for somebody who's been following this debate even a little bit, is, you know, did the FCC stand up to the big carriers today? And the answer is absolutely yes. This what's called a Title II approach, restoring their authority under broadband, that's what matters, because it's in having that authority that they can fix any problems that are in the order and deal with new and emerging threats. So that's why this is such a victory. Now, that we celebrate today. Tomorrow we have to get ready to fight again, because Congress is going to try to interfere with this. I was on TV today with Rep. Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee, and she was already threatening the FCC's budget. So, you know, they're going to do some things. They may try to do things. There'll be lawsuits, although I think the FCC is very well poised to win those lawsuits this time because of the decision they made today. So the fight is far from over, but it is a different fight going forward. And we're actually in a position to defend really good, strong rules and really good policy, and that's a much, much better position. Frankly, a position that seemed unthinkable, you know, even 3 months or 6 months ago.
But the country that invented the internet, the United States, has been slipping behind. And we mentioned the appalling national average of 9 megabits per second is the average speed internet users have in this country. And in a couple of exceptions, like North Carolina and Idaho and Chattanooga, Tennessee, you can get 1 gigabit. And that's standard in Japan, it's standard in South Korea, and even in France, where you get that kind of service at a quarter of the cost that you pay nowadays. So, in other words, the point I'm trying to make here, Craig, is that the victory today is sort of, you know, a holding action against a terrible trend. When are we going to turn it around and end up with a situation like the Japanese have, like the South Koreans and even the French have, where you have a utility that enables you to do enormous things with education, with health, and with business that other countries have, and they're cleaning our clock?
Well, that's absolutely the right question we need to be asking. I think it's one reason this fight was so important, because we had to show that we could achieve these very kind of baseline protections. And the next steps are really to look at, you know, the complete lack of competition, the fact that we're falling behind the rest of the world, and create the kind of incentives, you know, whether those are encouraging municipal developments, public-private partnerships, or even the big guys to actually serve their customers, that can help us catch up with everybody else. You know, in the end, what we want is public policy that encourages the deployment of gigabit fiber, that encourages big open pipes that can serve all of this content. That's very achievable. It just requires some investments. And I think that will be the big fight going forward. And it's one that we can really take this victory today and build upon to start having that conversation. And we need to have it soon. There's a big merger between Comcast and Time Warner Cable that will probably be decided this spring, and that's going to be a real test if of the FCC's resolve. Are they still willing to stand up to these guys? Was this a blip or exception? You know, in the end, I think that's going to be up for us to decide. If we can truly make the internet one of these third rail issues that no politician wants to be on the wrong side of, then I think we can achieve the kind of things you're talking about. And that's where, now that we finally reached this point in the net neutrality debate, while still defending that win, we can actually move to this larger conversation. And I think this is a great time to have it. There's very likely to be a Telecommunications Act rewrite in the next 5 years. And I think that, you know, we now have the opportunity, we now have the political momentum, we have the growing coalition to actually achieve some of what you're talking about. And I certainly couldn't agree with you more that that should be at the top of our priority list.
Well, Craig Aaron, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Craig Aaron, who's the president and CEO of Free Press and the editor and co-author of Changing Media, Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. Before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizens Congress Watch, and his latest article at the Huffington Post is How We Won Net Neutrality. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined by David Corn, who has exposed Bill O'Reilly's fabrications and is under attack for doing so.
Protect your eyes. Protect yourself from digital decay. Digital decay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Corn, the Washington Bureau Chief at Mother Jones Magazine. He has written for numerous publications and is a talk show regular, and his best-selling books include Hubris, The Inside Story of Spin Scandal, and The Selling of the Iraq War. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Corn.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And David, you've been doing some important reporting on Bill O'Reilly, and of course it follows Brian Williams, who was suspended for 6 months, and I don't think he's going to be coming back at NBC. He's paid a price. At the time this happened, Bill O'Reilly went on his Fox News show and castigated the cultural deception within the liberal media, saying that these distortions by left-leaning outlets are to be almost to be expected. And yet you have uncovered distortions by O'Reilly that we know there's a line between embellishment and fabrication, but it seems that he's gone way over that line into fabrication.
Well, you know, in the piece I do, and people can read it for themselves at motherjones.com, and I co-wrote it with my colleague Dan Shulman, we don't characterize it as, you know, embellishment, fabrication, lying. Other people have used those terms. What we show through, you know, in-depth reporting is that statements he's made about his wartime reporting experiences, particularly in Argentina when he really didn't cover the war, and El Salvador when he was there briefly, are not consistent with the factual record. You know, for instance, he said he was in the war zone in Argentina in the Falklands, during the Falklands War, which was in 1982 between the Brits and the Argentines. Well, he got there 3 days before the war ended, and he was in Buenos Aires. Buenos Aires was 1,200 miles away from where the war was happening, which was on the Falkland Islands, which are 300 miles off the coast of southern Argentina. No American reporter got to the Falklands. So Bill O'Reilly saying that he was in the war zone, which he has said a few times during the Falklands War, would seem to be not consistent with the known record, and not the proper use of the phrase war zone. There was no fighting. He has said that because he covered a protest after the war was over that got violent, the police used rubber bullets and tear gas, that was a combat-like situation. But again, he has said about that experience that he saw Argentine soldiers mowing down civilians with real bullets and that many were killed, when it's clear from the record of the time, from the reports of the time, and from other CBS News correspondents, of which O'Reilly was one back then, that nothing like that happened. There were no deaths. There were no fatalities. And an Argentine historian of the Falklands War who was at the protest says nobody was killed. It was, you know, things got a little ugly, but no one was killed. So in all these instances, we have Bill O'Reilly, you know, claiming to do things, to have seen things, and similarly in El Salvador, that is contradicted by the record. And in one of his recountings of his Falklands experience, he talks about saving a cameraman who, while in the war zone, when they were being chased by Argentine troops, his cameraman fell and was injured, and O'Reilly saved him in some manner or form. Well, it didn't happen in the Falklands. He wasn't there. CBS News people have told CNN, after our story came out, that no cameraman was injured at the protest. So he has talked about this in a heroic manner, or to show that he's a battle-hardened combat vet, but yet the facts that can be ascertained don't show that. And while O'Reilly has, you know, accused me of being a liar and attacked Mother Jones and said the article is a piece of garbage, he has yet to refute a single fact in the article.
Well, given that there is a line between embellishment and fabrication, we all embellish our resumes, but it would seem to me that in journalism, if you cross that line, it's fatal. And it certainly has proven so for Brian Williams. It's not proving so far for Bill O'Reilly. Is that perhaps because he's really not a journalist?
Well, Bill O'Reilly says he's a journalist, and he says he operates in a no-spin zone. So I think right away he's setting a pretty, you know, high standard for himself as a commentator. But that's what he says. Now, to me, it's interesting that when we did the story at Mother Jones here, we sent a long list of questions to O'Reilly and Fox News about everything we were, you know, going to post about. And he and Fox decided not to answer a single question, not to respond to us at all. And then when the story came out, just respond with personal invective and threatening rhetoric. So, you know, you think a lot of journalists would, when challenged on, you know, key factual matters, would respond by presenting an explanation, counterfacts. Brian Williams apologized and said he didn't quite understand how he misremembered, but he didn't challenge all the eyewitness accounts and recollections that proved that what he said about being in a copter, being shot down, or being shot at in a copter was not correct. Fox News has rallied around him. You know, he's in the days after our story came out, other stories have come out about him, you know, seemingly telling stories in his Kennedy book and about his trip to El Salvador that are not consistent with the known facts. And they're not responding. They're not explaining. They just keep saying, he's a great reporter. He's a great journalist. We stand by our guy. So that's their strategy. Right now, he still has a job, and Brian Williams is suspended.
And again, I'm speaking with David Korn, who's the Washington Bureau Chief at Mother Jones Magazine. He has written for numerous publications and is a talk show regular. And his best-selling books include Hubris, The Inside Story of Spin Scandal, and The Selling of the Iraq War. And he's been doing the lead reporting on uncovering the record of Bill O'Reilly as a war correspondent, which seems incredibly fictional. He did say about El Salvador on a radio show in 2012, on his Fox News show, O'Reilly said that he saw nuns in El Salvador get shot in the back of the head while covering the civil war down there. He also has gone on the record and saying that he witnessed or heard the gunshots that killed a friend of Lee Harvey Oswald's, who was his sort of CIA handler, a guy called Georges de Morenschild, who apparently it's been thoroughly established that when O'Reilly claimed to have witnessed or heard this killing or the suicide of this man down in Florida, he was in fact, O'Reilly was at a Dallas television station in Dallas. So in terms of Fox News circling the wagons and protecting him, at what point do you think reality will intrude? Because quite often they seem to be more in the business of promoting fiction over fact.
Well, Ian, your question presumes that reality will intrude at some point. Listen, I'm not in this to bash O'Reilly or bash Fox News. I mean, despite the fact that, you know, he's calling me names and they're trying to discredit me, and it's, you know, pretty ugly from their side. I think that my story speaks for itself, the story I did with Dan Shulman. And, it's, you know, other people can read it and evaluated and come to whatever conclusions they want to about Bill O'Reilly and what his standing should or shouldn't be with Fox News. But to me, it's, you know, again, telling that when Brian Williams, when issues were raised about Brian Williams, you know, NBC immediately announced that they'd be looking into it, and they saw this as a serious matter. With Bill O'Reilly, not just the reporting that we did, but these other accounts that you've mentioned, you know, it doesn't seem to sway or, you know, Fox or influence Fox News to do anything different. I mean, they put out a statement in response to the fact that, you know, O'Reilly said that he saw nuns being gunned down in El Salvador. And those of us who are old enough, you and I, Ian, will remember that during the El Salvador Civil War, there were some terrible incidents with nuns, of all people, being killed by death squads. It was horrific, absolutely horrific. American nuns who were working down there, too. And it just turns out that the last, you know, episode of that, last instance of nuns being killed, were at the end of 1980, and Bill O'Reilly didn't get to El Salvador until 1981, maybe even the end of 1981. So he could not have seen what he says he saw. So Fox News last night puts out a statement saying, oh, he saw pictures. He saw images of this. But when you say, I was in El Salvador and I saw nuns gunned down by guys, I saw guys shot in
the back of the head, he said.
Yeah, and I saw guys gunning down nuns. By any reasonable interpretation, when you say it in those ways, you're saying that you yourself experienced this. But yet they just come out and say, no, he saw photographs or videotape. I don't know why there'd be videotape of this. I think the death squads were not in the habit of videotaping themselves committing human rights abuses and murder. But nevertheless, and that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And as long as 2 million plus Americans tune into his show each night, and he generates, I don't know, I'm throwing out a figure here, $100 million a year in revenue from Fox News, that seems to be, maybe that's all that matters.
Well, I find it very troubling, though, in general. It's obviously easy to make fun of Fox News because they, if you watch the Fox and Friends and these shows, this, the spin zone is so hilarious, politically speaking. And to some extent, you know, MSNBC has tried to sort of do it on the other side, but not in the kind of relentless and crass way. But what I find troubling is I spent a lot of time in the Soviet Union working on arms control. And I met a lot of Soviet journalists at the time with TASS and Pravda. And, you know, some of them were KGB guys, the ones that served abroad. But by and large, you felt really sorry for these guys because they had to print the party line and they didn't have a choice as journalists. But here in this free country, the idea that a media outlet would choose to be the mouthpiece of the Republican Party or a Republican president, as they were under George W. Bush, is, to me, it seems incredibly un-American.
Well, you know, I wouldn't agree with you precisely on that. You know, there are people out there with conservative views and they want conservative news, and I worked at Fox for 7 years. I was one of the few liberal commentators. I was happy when they didn't renew a bunch of commentator contracts, mine included, and I could then talk to CNN and eventually end up with a contract at MSNBC. But you know, I don't begrudge people having or mounting a conservative news operation. I never liked the fact that they thought that they say they're fair and balanced, because I don't believe that's the case. I don't believe many people are fair and balanced, but if they just wanted to call themselves conservative news for conservatives, that would have been fine with me. But there's still what bothers me more, and they can do the party line for however they like, whatever they think gets some money, whatever type of journalism they want to do. But to me, it's still always about standards, accuracy, and fairness. I believe you could have a completely conservative, news outlet that is also completely fair, accurate, and it has high journalistic standards.
Well, Shepard Smith, I think, is there one exception. I mean,
Shep does good stuff, and Brett Baer, I like Brett Baer. I think he's hasn't been great on Benghazi, but I think he's done other things. He was the one who asked Mitt Romney about poverty, and every once in a while, Chris Wallace, you know, takes on a little bit of a different, more confrontational approach to a Republican, you know, than you would expect at Fox. And you know, when Tony Snow was there, I did a lot of work with Tony, and I liked him a lot, and he was fair, and he gave me my say, and I thought he was fair-minded. So I don't think it's impossible to have a high-quality conservative news outlet. But you gotta, you know, but the people there have to care about facts and getting things right. And if you make mistakes, you know, correcting them. And if you say things that are not true, owning up to that. And if people who work for you, you know, don't meet these standards or they threaten other journalists, doing something about it.
Right, but more often than not, liberals on Fox are sacrificial lambs. They're literally set up to be ridiculed. And
that's true. And people, you know, but I think everyone realizes that. And it's, you know, when I was on, I try to hold my own, and I thought I often did. But it, you know, but you certainly are the visiting team. You know, it really feels like you're ganged up on. It's like three versus one. But that also happens on MSNBC when I'm on MSNBC with, like, Michael Steele or a Republican consultant. And, you know, often they're the odd man or woman out in terms of being a conservative versus people who are, you know, not conservative or centrist or left of center. I don't see any problem with that. To me, it's all about how you do it and whether you do it accurately and fairly. That's all. And if, you know, I often think that Fox doesn't meet those standards. I wish they would. I don't mind having a conservative, you know, station. But here, you know, because of their, you know, they've kind of created a culture of their own in which Bill O'Reilly doesn't have to answer any of the specific facts we present in our piece. He can, you know, call me tremendously, you know, awful names. He can hold up, you know, proof, you know, so-called proof memos and show videotape that actually don't prove what he says they prove, and then say, look, this proves my point. And there's no vetting of that. Nobody sort of questions that. I wrote a piece the other day that, after O'Reilly tried to counter our story with so-called evidence that really didn't address the issues, that, you know, he was sort of pushing, you know, what I would call proofiness, the appearance of proof. You just assert it, and it's there. He went on Fox News on Howard Kurtz's show on Sunday, and to try to make it seem as if he had covered a protest in which that met his description of troops firing into crowds, he read a New York Times account dispatch from the time in which it noted a policeman fired shots. He then left out the next five words of the sentence. The policeman fired shots, I don't know if it's five, over the heads of fleeing demonstrators. which proved our point. Our point was that no one fired, you know, there were no civilian casualties. The troops and, you know, he said troops, but troops, neither troops nor police, fired real bullets into the crowd. So he left off the words that undermined his own point on a media show on Fox. And, you know, that day or the next day, the reporter, the New York Times reporter, Richard Meislin, who wrote that story, put up a Facebook post saying that that O'Reilly had misquoted him and had dropped those words. Some of us had noticed that already, but it was certainly, you know, more important coming from the author himself. And can you imagine in any newsroom, or if Brian Williams had done that, what the penalty might have been for, you know, basically fudging?
Right.
He read all the sentences beforehand, all the sentences afterwards. He just left off those five words.
And I take it Howard Kurtz didn't pull him over.
No, Howard Kurtz didn't say anything at the time. He didn't know it, but certainly, you know, he runs the media show. He was bamboozled. He was hoodwinked by Bill O'Reilly. And has he written about it, tweeted about it? Is he going to have him on the show this week to go over that again?
But if you were invited, and I know you won't be, David Corn, to appear on his show, a former Congressman, Barney Frank, who sparred with O'Reilly, said that, quoting, "When you go on his show, you have two choices, either be reasonable and let him dominate with his ranting or yell back at him. So either you look timid or as boorish as he is." So that seems to be, you know, it seems to be more of a trap. I wonder why anybody...
It is a trap. And as I say, I've done his... When I was working at Fox, I did his show, and he often said to me, you know, "You're a great guest. Thanks for being on. You're a good reporter." You know, didn't call me a liar back then, but now he does. But, he hasn't asked me to come on the show. Mm-hmm. You know, I get all these tweets from conservative trolls who say, you know, "Why don't you man up and go on the show?" Well, Bill O'Reilly hasn't invited me. Now, I'm not saying I would go on. In fact, I have a MSNBC contract now. I work at MSNBC, and I'm contractually prohibited from going on other shows and other networks unless I get permission from MSNBC, so I couldn't say yes without dealing with that. But nevertheless, I think at this stage of the game, were he to invite me, which I don't think will ever happen, I think the proper response would be, "Why don't we both appear on a CNN show?" Or, "Why don't we both go on C-SPAN?"
Right.
"Why don't we both go to the 92nd Street Y? Let's do it that way."
Right, or Muskets at Dawn, right. So
yeah.
So just in closing, though, Sally Quinn, who's a veteran Washington insider and a friend of O'Reilly, says, "O'Reilly is an entertainer, and everything he does is totally subjective, including his memories. To attack him is simply to increase his ratings and the sales of his phenomenally popular books. Lighten up, everybody." What do you think of that advice?
I saw that remark by Sally, who I know. And it saddened me. Sally is the widow of Ben Bradley. Ben Bradley, the editor of the Washington Post during the Watergate years, an irascible, great journalist, kind of symbolizes the take no prisoners or take no guff journalist who is willing to confront power and take on those who don't tell the truth. And so for Sally to say, you know, forget about this here, Bill O'Reilly is indeed the number one cable news host. He says, he doesn't accept Sally's description. He says he tells the truth. He says he operates in a no-spin zone. And so when he gets out there and talks to you about the news of the day and reports stories and tries to, break news of his own at times, that he's doing it honestly. He was the one, he got up there after Brian Williams was suspended and said that this shows that the mainstream media engages in deception all the time, left-wing deception. It's full of liberal distortions, and it's corrupt, that the media is corrupt. He considers himself a journalist and part of the media. So it seems, I don't really understand Sally's point. Is she saying that, because we shouldn't take him seriously as a truth teller, that there, anytime he says something that may not, conform to the facts, we should just give him a pass? Is that her point? I was a little confused by it. But just taking O'Reilly on his own terms, it seems he can be put under the magnifying glass, examined under the microscope, and vetted the way he does other people.
Well, but he's a classic bully. He doesn't want that. He won't take it. He's responded by calling you names, and I doubt whether he will ever allow himself to be actually questioned in any reasonable way. I mean, that's...
people don't need to hear me talk about whether Bill O'Reilly is a bully or not. There's plenty of YouTube videos out there if that's what you care about. And, at the end of the day, I just come back to what was the responsibility that Mother Jones, I, and Daniel Shulman, the co-writer in the piece, had here. We put out facts. We worked hard and long on this story. We were very careful, and I thought we were very fair in our characterizations. And it's really up to the rest of the world to read, absorb, debate, fight, and to hold anyone to account if they believe so. And you know, the fact that Bill O'Reilly can't engage seriously with the facts, well, people can judge that. And the fact that Fox News stands by him no matter what he says about the in his books about Kennedy or about watching seeing nuns killed or about being in war zones, well, you know, people can judge that too. You can't force. It's very hard to force, Fox News, which makes $100 million or more from Bill O'Reilly, to do something about Bill O'Reilly.
Well, David Corn, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Okay, and I just really encourage people to please don't take my word for anything here. Mm-hmm. Just go online, go to MotherJones.com, read the story, look at how Bill O'Reilly's has responded, and come to your own judgment. And you, of course, can follow me at DavidCornDC on Twitter, where I've been tweeting a lot about this.
Well, again, David, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Corn, who's the Washington Bureau Chief at Mother Jones Magazine. He has written for numerous publications and is a talk show regular. His best-selling books include Hubris, The Inside Story of Spin Scandal, and The Selling of the Iraq War. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the Boston bombers and the two Uzbeks and the one Azeri charged with plotting to kill the president slipped through the net. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gordon Hahn, who is an adjunct professor at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies in Monterey and an analyst and advisory board member of the Geostrategic Forecasting Corporation. And he is the author of Russia's Islamic Threat and Russia's Revolution from Above. And he has taught at several universities in the United States and is a Fulbright Scholar at St. Petersburg State University in Russia. And his latest book just out is The Caucasus Emirate Mujahideen, Global Jihadism in Russia's North Caucasus and Beyond. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gordon Hahn.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
And it's a more than a coincidence now, it would seem, that some of the biggest terrorist incidents in this country, and one that was apparently just prevented by arrests yesterday by the FBI involving two Uzbeks and a Russian emigre from Azerbaijan. And then you add to that the Sanarov brothers responsible for the Boston bombing. What's going on there in terms of how the United States vets people from the former Soviet Union? I just find it pretty extraordinary.
Well, unfortunately, there's not sufficient vetting going on in terms of our immigration policy. Unfortunately, the President of the United States, I think, believes that he's as much the President of the world than he is of the United States of America. And basically, immigration policy should be based on three pillars, essentially. One would be, and the most important, would be security, that is ensuring that any immigrants allowed into the country cannot harm the interests of Americans, no less talking about the possibility of terrorists getting in and carrying out terrorist attacks and killing Americans. The other would be that they cause no economic harm, that is, they contribute more economically to the country than they take away, and the third would be that they contribute socially as well, more positively than negatively. And unfortunately, there's no serious vetting going on. We're not taking the jihadi threat seriously enough when it comes to immigration, when it comes to securing the borders. And that's not just with regard to immigration from the former Soviet Union. That's actually a lesser problem. The greater problem would be those coming from more traditionally Muslim countries. where obviously the situation in many of these countries is out of control in terms of the jihadi threat and the more peaceful but no less dangerous Islamist threat. And if you allow large numbers of immigrants coming into the United States from such countries, you're bound to have a few dangerous characters come in along with them.
Well, since you've worked extensively on Russia's Islamic threat and understand it better than most people, at the time of the Sanarov story, the Boston bombing, the Russians indicated that they had alerted the FBI about the older brother, and somehow it slipped through the cracks. What was the arrangement with the U.S. intelligence people and the Russian intelligence people on their Islamic threat and it possibly migrating here to the United States? And where does it stand now?
Well, largely there's been a long-term pattern since the mid-90s of denying the jihadi nature of some of the Chechen separatists leading up to the early 2000s. And then by 2002, the jihadi wing of the Chechen Republic of Ichkeria, as it was called at the time, the resistance movement or the separatist movement, became just as strong as the nationalist wing. And by 2007, the jihadi wing had taken over, and they declared the Caucasus Emirate. They abolished the Chechen Republic of Ichkeria. And since the 2007 founding of the Caucasus Emirate, they've carried out, or people inspired by them in the North Caucasus and Russia, have carried out almost 3,000 attacks of various kinds, including 55 suicide bombings, although there was only one last year. And more and more often, we're seeing the Caucasus Emirate become globalized and deterritorialized. That is, it's becoming deeply integrated into the global jihadi revolutionary movement or alliance, and many of its fighters are now leaving and going abroad to fight in Iraq and Syria, where there are at least 7 or 8 major, or 4 or 5 major jihadi groups in Syria and Iraq, with leaders who are from the North Caucasus and or the Caucasus, and another 3 or 4 or 5 smaller groups or jamaats. Led by people from the North Caucasus. Most of these people tend to be Chechens, but not all of them. The most recent evidence is that that emirs from the Caucasus Emirate based in the North Caucasus recently declared their loyalty to the Islamic State. And Amir, the Caliph, so-called Caliph Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, those emirs, in theory, represent up to 80% of the mujahideen based in the North Caucasus, with the caveat that many of those have already left for Syria and Iraq. There's also a Caucasus Emirate cell in Afghanistan, and there's also a Caucasus Emirate cell in Yemen. So it's become a global jihadi movement in a way, even in and of itself, and it's deeply embedded into the global jihad. And many of the fighters who are fighting abroad have vowed to return to the North Caucasus. So when Russia says that there is an ISIS threat or ISIL threat or Islamic State threat to Russia, that is in fact the case. And all this is evidence to show that since the mid-90s, there's been a growing nexus between separatists and jihadists in the North Caucasus and the global jihad, which was repeatedly denied and is still being denied in some quarters in Washington, D.C.
So, Gordon, what then do we make of the fact that these two Uzbeks and this Azeri that were rolled up by the FBI yesterday, one was the bankroller down in Florida, the one was about to get on a plane, and the other one to Turkey to join, allegedly to join the Islamic State in Syria, and the other was making plans as well. They managed to get hold of all of their online chat, but they've been working through a Russian site. I thought the Russians were obviously the FBI is, you know, watching Russian sites, but I thought the Russians were also, since, you know, Putin's taken over Russia's Facebook, VKontakte, etc., you'd think that the Russians would be onto them as well.
Well, you can't cover everything. There have been times when I've gone to Russia, for example, and I've tried to get onto some of the jihadi sites to do my research, and sometimes you can and sometimes you cannot. It depends on which site. So this is a this is a general problem for all governments, that there's just so much to keep track of that it becomes very difficult, you know, to find the needles in the haystack. And this is one of the reasons why immigration needs to be tightened up coming from these countries. The fact that two Uzbeks have shown up in this case is not surprising, because the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan and the Islamic Jihad Union, which grew out of the IMU, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, have done what the Caucasus Emirate essentially has done. They've emigrated from Central Asia, and they are now based in Waziristan, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And some of those fighters are coming over into Iraq and Syria to join up with either Jabhat al-Nusra or the Islamic State. So that's not surprising. Why they would have come here first, and whether they had jihadist leanings before they came to the United States, it's not clear. I still don't have any information on how long they've been here and so forth. But clearly they would have been inspired by groups like the IMU and the IJU, which were based originally in Uzbekistan and are made up largely of Uzbeks. And there are also a large number of Kazakhs now also, by the way, fighting in both with ISIL and ISIS and in Central Asia. And there's actually a Jamaat that's based in, of Kazakhs based in AFPAC, that would like to return to Central Asia. In terms of Azerbaijan, Azerbaijan's in a particularly vulnerable position because it's located between the North Caucasus, where the Caucasus Emirate is based, and Turkey and Iraq and Syria. And a lot of the fighters are traveling from the North Caucasus, and not just from the North Caucasus, but other places in Russia, and Central Asia, through Azerbaijan to Turkey, and then into Syria, and then on to Iraq. And there has been an increase in the number of arrests made in Azerbaijan of jihadists going to and from, going through Azerbaijan on their way to in one direction or the other. And so I think Azerbaijan is in a particularly vulnerable position at this point, as is Turkey.
Well, just in closing, Gordon Hahn, since your expertise is on Russia's Islamic threat and you spend a lot of time there, presumably you have some connections to the Russian intelligence people. What is the state of the relationship now between the U.S. and Russia in terms of intelligence sharing, given tensions over Ukraine?
Actually, I have no connections with any intelligence services anywhere. Even in the United States, rarely am consulted on these issues. From my understanding, that since the outbreak of the situation in Ukraine, which is another interesting story in of itself, intelligence cooperation has declined. However, the fact that FSB Chief Alexander Bortnikov was invited to the conference on extremism at the organized by the White House last week and actually gave a presentation, suggests that at least on that issue, perhaps Bortnikov was here to say we need to restore that cooperation because of the rising tide of the Islamic State.
Well, Gordon Hahn, I thank you very much for joining us here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.